May it please the court.
Sure.
I want to take a moment to apologize to Mr. Slavey and to the court. I don't know exactly when I went from whippersnapper to geezer, but probably when I became a father-in-law as opposed to just a father. But I should have introduced Mr. Slavey, and it just completely slipped my mind, and I apologize.
That is fine. Fortunately, I was able to provide some of the information you might otherwise have provided. So.
The appellants in this case are the paternal grandparents of Rory, who is now 10. The respondents are his co-guardians, the maternal great-grandmother and great-aunt. The grandparents filed a petition for visitation and custody in the family court division in St. Louis City. The guardians moved to dismiss on two bases: failure to state a claim and lack of standing. The trial court dismissed the petition with prejudice on the basis of failure to state a claim. Now, this court and the Court of Appeals before it review this case on a de novo basis. What's in the petition? What does it say? And we review it in the light most favorable to the grandparents. And most importantly, we review the allegations of the petition. And we don't really consider the procedural litany that guardians have pointed us to, because that's not what the issue is in front of the trial court. It's what does the petition say? We also don't assess credibility. We don't make an assessment based on whether the trial court thinks it's likely to be persuaded by the factual allegations or the chances of success once the evidence is presented. Those facts are assumed to be true. Simply put, under TQL, the grandparents here stated a cause of action. They said that the grandparents, they had a good relationship with the child. They had provided emotional and financial support. They previously had liberal custody and visitation, and in fact, the child had lived with them for some period of time. There was a strong bond, and it was in the best interest of the child, and his welfare required some sort of visitation, temporary custody.
Can you clarify the facts? Are the grandparents now getting visitation?
No.
Informally? They're not seeing the child at all?
They're not seeing the child.
Okay.
The guardian's position was, no, you can't do it. First, they said, you're limited to the grandparent visitation statute, and Judge McGraw discussed that at some length in his judgment. The problem is that's not what the grandparent visitation statute is meant for. It's not, first of all, meant to be exclusive, and it doesn't really provide for custody. It provides, in essence, a limited remedy, some sort of visitation. I think the cases are pretty clear. You couldn't rely upon the grandparent visitation statute and say, I want Siegenthaler. I want every other weekend and one night during the week and 6 weeks in the summer. That's not what the grandparent visitation statute applies to. Moreover, 452.375, the custody statute, doesn't limit itself either. It doesn't say that the provisions here, when we're talking about people that can ask for custody, apply to anybody but a grandparent. That's not what it says. And in fact, the cases, Jones, Young, both of those cases are cited in our brief, and I think we're in the Court of Appeals opinion as well, indicate that grandparents can be custodians under 452.375.
But under that statute, can you bring a third-party action after letters of guardianship have already been issued?
I think guardianship just provides guardianship. It doesn't make any determination with regard to custody. In fact, I don't think that a guardianship court would have the authority to do that. So, for example, in my original reply brief in the Court of Appeals, I referenced ALR out of the Western District. And that the opinion in the Western District said the guardianship court doesn't have any authority to do anything with regard to custody or visitation. It just determines guardianship. Now, I know that opinion's gone, so I had to rework a few things. And Judge Wilson, I think you even observed that you thought maybe that the guardianship court could do that. During oral argument of ALR, but I don't see any case law that says that, And in fact, I think if you look at the guardianship statute, the guardianship statute sets out what can be done, but it doesn't give the guardianship court the ability to determine custody or visitation issues. So I think if the grandparents went to the guardianship court right now, first of all, they've already been kind of kicked out because they've been told they're not interested parties. But secondly, if they went and asked for that, I do not believe the Commissioner Connigan in the city of St. Louis would have the authority to say, okay, you've got, if he found that it was in the child's best interest. I don't think he could say, well, we'll give you, you know, once every couple weeks for an afternoon or whatever it may be. I don't think he's got that authority. So I don't think that the initiation or the entry of the guardianship per se prevents them from being able to pursue anything under 452-375. Moreover, some of the concerns about using or limiting grandparents because of Troxel, though they don't apply here. We are not infringing upon any rights of a parent. Neither actual parent are involved in this case at all, and haven't, I don't think, really since the guardianship was entered. We're talking about dealing with grandparents and a great-grandmother and a great-aunt. And I don't think that the Troxel concerns about constitutional limitations on allowing for that apply here at all. The third reason that the guardians have objected is that you can't proceed with an independent action at all. That you have to be bringing this as a result of some other action or in conjunction with some other action. Judge Russell, I think under TQL, I think it's pretty clear that you can have an independent action, and I think that the cases that have decided similar issues since then in the various courts of appeal, even if they have not allowed people to proceed, say in an adoption proceeding, for example, or a step-parent adoption proceeding, have said you still have an independent cause of action. You can go file your independent cause of action under TQL, but we're not dealing with custody or visitation here. We're just dealing with adoption. So this is not the appropriate time and place for you to be bringing your concerns before the court.
But those were the initial determinations by the court.
I'm sorry?
That was the initial determination by the court of custody and visitation. And then a modification isn't necessarily brought under this statute. Is that fair to say?
That a modification is not brought under 452-375?
Mm-hmm.
It is.
It's the basis for the modification, the justification for that. Now it could be used to determine the factors could be used.
If you were bringing a modification proceeding, if there was already a custody determination, you said, okay, mom's got custody and dad gets every other weekend and one of the grandparents or great aunt or somebody wanted to come into play, you would probably, my guess is that it would probably be some sort of hybrid of 452-375 and 410. I'm not too sure that it's been fleshed out that you have to show a change in circumstances since the entry of the prior judgment for a third party to necessarily be able to come in. It could be interpreted that way, but I'm not aware of any cases that specifically say that.
Well, so what if you have mom and dad who are married and their minor child resides with them and they're not in the process of dissolution and they decide that grandma and grandpa are not to interact with the child? Would they have the right to bring this action as an independent action there where there's no proceeding at all?
Well, clearly they don't have the right to bring it under the grandparent visitation statute because the statute specifically says that. I think they could. I think they could plead it, and I think they could survive a motion to dismiss. Then the question is going to be, can they prove it?
Well, don't you then have the Troxel situation?
I'm sorry?
Doesn't Troxel then apply?
I think the concerns of Troxel would then apply because then you'd be impinging upon the constitutionally protected rights of the parents. And I think, you know, even at that then, you'd have to show, probably you would have to show that both of those parents are unfit. Or in some way, shape, or form, it would be in the best interest, or it would be in the welfare of the child demanded it. I know last time I was here, Judge Wilson, We tried to figure out what best interest of the child was, and I don't know that we concluded that or figured out what it was, as opposed to better interests or some sort of incremental improvement. I'm not smart enough to be able to say what the difference is between best interests and welfare of the child demands. I haven't been able to figure out the cases that talk about that.
Well, stay with me a minute, though.
Okay.
In what way is a guardian, not a petitioner for guardianship, but a guardian, different than the natural parent? What rights do they not possess that a natural parent in the ordinary state possesses?
I think they possess the rights that are granted to it under the statute. Now, I can't think of anything off the top of my head that would be different. You wouldn't have the ability to, or the child wouldn't have the ability to inherit from the guardian. So that would be a difference.
Well, that's a child's right, but the I'm concerned with the guardian's rights, because if a parent has the right of legal custody and physical custody, and then in dissolutions those two sort of wander apart on occasion, but in a guardianship there hasn't been any effort to divide those two realms. And why doesn't a guardian then have, like a natural parent, the right of both legal determination and physical determination? They decide where the child goes and with whom the child interacts as a natural parent would.
I think the statute gives them that right, but I don't think they have a constitutional interest.
No, I'm not suggesting that the Troxell considerations apply. I'm just trying to figure out what it is then that the grandparents are, do they stand in a different relationship to a guardian than they do to a natural parent or parents?
The child?
Do the grandparents.
Oh. I think they do, but I haven't seen any cases, quite frankly, from a factual perspective that would spell that exactly what that would be.
So if the statute wouldn't give them a grandparent the independent action against the natural parents, why would that statute apply to give rise to an independent action against the legal parent?
I think the statute could apply in that regard. For example, in TQL, you had a non-biological parent who had the ability to bring an action under 452.375 against the mother. And it was unclear to me, or it's unclear to me now, I may have known it at one point, exactly what the situation was with regard to the biological father and what rights he had and what his involvement with the child was and all of that. But there you had someone who was not biologically related to the child at all bringing an action against the individual that appeared to be the only biological connection to the child, the only parent, and so he was able to bring that action. Here you have grandparents. I mean, my clients are more closely related to this child, well, maybe not biologically because their son is adopted, but at least in terms, I mean, so we don't have that issue, but I mean, if you looked at it, we're talking about maternal great-grandmother and great-aunt as opposed to grandparents on the other side. So in one respect, they even have potentially a stronger argument for trying to maintain a close relationship with that child than the guardians themselves.
Any other questions?
I think I'm over time.
We'll hear from you in rebuttal.
Thank you.
May it please the court.
Certainly.
The trial court properly dismissed the appellant's motion for custody and visitation in this case. One of the principal underlying reasons is because an initial custody determination had already been made. And that's a key distinction in this case. TQL applying 452.375 was an initial custody determination.
It was a paternity action, wasn't it?
That's correct. And in that case, Judge, as you know, one of the biggest issues that was pled in the petition and what was analyzed very factually heavily in the opinion was the fact that the allegations were that both biological parents were unfit, unwilling, or unable to assume natural guardianship. And therefore, because of the third-party prong that was being pled, it survived a motion to dismiss. Well, in our case, the great-grandmother, Peggy Carroll, has cared for Rory since he was about 3 years old. In 2009, she applied for guardianship for Rory, who lived exclusively in her home. And at that time, she alleged, of course, that both biological parents were unfit, unwilling, and unable, as is part of the application of 452.375. And in that case, the probate court held a contested trial at which the appellants were involved in that case. And the court determined that the parents were unfit, unwilling, and unable, and essentially then ruled that my client, Peggy Carroll, was an appropriate guardian for the child. And that is a custody determination.
Is there any forum for raising, they're saying here they were very involved in the child's life prior to that and after that have been totally cut off, and that that's not in the best interests of the child?
I did want to address that, Your Honor. My client, for a significant period of time after the guardianship, there was formal visitation between the grandparents and the child. Still now, they go to sporting events, school programs. They do see Rory, but for a number of reasons that aren't before the court, there has been no formal visitation between the parties. But to answer your question, Judge, there's no common law right for a grandparent to have time with their child. And that's essentially the point. In a marriage situation, for whatever reasons the parents have, they choose not to allow their child to see the grandparent. There's no right then, common law-wise, for a grandparent to intercede and attempt to get court-ordered visitation.
But Troxell said that's because of the rights of the parents, and that goes back to Judge Wilson's questions. Why is it the same with the guardian, where you don't have the parents with their natural right to decide who can see their children?
I think the same reasoning applies, Judge, because there's no common law right, again, for a grandparent to have time with a child. My clients, the Carrolls, have been court-appointed as the legal custodians of Rory. They have a fundamental obligation to care for this child. They choose what is in this child's best interests, and they have determined that it is not in the child's best interest to spend time with the appellants. And there's nothing statutorily that entitles the appellants to seek the relief that they're seeking.
You indicated if there's no common law right, then your position is there would have to be a statute that would expressly allow this.
And there are statutes that do allow, of course, third parties to step in and essentially take authority as a legal custodian. And that's, of course, the guardianship statute. And that's also under 452.402. In limited circumstances, grandparents are entitled to visitation with a child. But that is the correct point, I believe, that the intent of 452.375 was not to give some broad, unlimited right for any third party to step in and seek custody of a child or visitation of a child. That's for the legislature to enact. And currently, under these statutes, the appellants don't have the right to seek the relief they are requesting.
Couldn't they file another motion for guardianship in the probate court and seek to have guardianship granted to them as opposed to the current guardians?
They had that opportunity, Your Honor, in 2009 to seek guardianship at the time that Mrs. Carroll did. They chose not to do that at that time.
But couldn't they, because of some change in circumstances, do so today because of the best interest of the child?
They could claim, I suppose, that the Carrolls are unfit, unwilling, or unable to act as guardians for some reason, which is noticeably absent from the petition they filed in the family court.
Are the statutes you're referring to, they would have to ask for removal of them as guardians and claim their denial of visitation was a circumstance?
I thought co-guardians were added earlier. Why couldn't that be also a relief they might request?
Your Honor, I do not believe, well, I don't know if, and quite honestly, I do not know if they could seek some sort of application for co-guardianship at this point. The probate court, after several applications by the appellants to intervene, to set aside the guardianship, to remove the guardians, did deny their relief in that case.
Did in those cases, and I know that's not before us, but in those cases, did the they cite this statute suggesting they should be able to intervene when because the probate court was determining the custody and visitation of the children and arguably the best interest.
452.375, I don't believe would apply to the custody finding in the probate court. I do agree that the court does determine custody under the guardianship statute, but doesn't have authority by statute to grant visitation to any other party. And that is essentially what the court found in that case, that the appellants weren't entitled to court-ordered visitation because it's not statutorily allowed.
Did they appeal that judgment?
They did not appeal that request. And that is one danger of the application of 452.375 that the appellants are claiming here. Because, for example, had they been applicants in the 2009 guardianship and the court had determined the parents were unfit, unwilling, and unable, my clients were the suitable custodians for the child, it was in the child's best interest, what they argue is the very next day after that judgment was entered, they could then file an application under 452.375 and ask for the exact same thing again under a third-party scheme. And I don't believe in any scenario that is what the legislature intended, and I don't believe that that's what was intended by the opinion in TQL. That was a limited, unique circumstance, and again, a factual scenario regarding claims that the biological parents were unfit. And in that case, there was not an interpretation of the welfare language that's included in 375. There is a key distinction, though. Mr. Gillespie said, I'm not really sure the difference between best interests and welfare of the child, but courts have made it clear that welfare of the child is not remotely the same as best interests of the child. That requires special and extraordinary circumstances which were not pled by the appellants in their motion. And in that scenario, you must have a higher burden, a higher factual allegation to meet to try to seek that type of a third-party claim. There were no allegations like that in this motion. It's not a best interest determination. And again, you have to rely on the fact that the probate court has already determined what was in Rory's best interest. That court still retains jurisdiction over that custody determination until guardianship is terminated for any reason. The authority for Rory's custody resides in probate court and should not.
Well, I mean, that brings up the question, though. Why couldn't the court condition that the grant of authority to the guardian on whatever conditions that judge thought were appropriate? You know, I am going to issue letters of guardianship to you, and I am telling you, as a condition of that, I want you to keep this child active in scouting. Why would that not be appropriate? Why isn't that within the probate judge's discretion?
I don't think that's outside of the court's discretion.
Well, if it can do that, why can't it say, and I want this child to have reasonable access to his maternal grandparents?
I think all courts, when they render decisions regarding custody, I think that's a common thing you'll hear in a court's decision. We hope that you will continue family involvements and determine what's in the best interest of a child.
Well, and by hope they mean, and if you don't, I'm going to come back and revoke your guardianship.
And I don't know in that unique circumstance if a court could say, because you haven't done what I imagined you would do as the custodian of the child, I'm therefore going to revoke guardianship. I don't know of any scenario where that would be
authorized. We certainly do that in dissolutions where you don't let the other party have enough time with the child or create obstacles or create enmity. That's taken into consideration.
And I do agree with that, but that's, again, under a different scenario or a different statutory scheme and a modification of custody or visitation where there is a heightened standard of proof, a heightened burden of proof to show that there's a change in circumstances that would warrant this. And in that scenario, I agree the court might determine that alienation had applied or something like that that would require a change in the custody schedule. But Those allegations have not even been made in this case. But again, to say that you have a, so to speak, a fresh bite at the apple under 452.375 to contest custody at any time, I think is the danger of the application the appellants are seeking here. They could lose, let's say they somehow survived a motion to dismiss. You put the guardians in a constant position of having to defend allegations of custody, visitation that are different than what the probate court has already ordered. And even if they win one trial, that doesn't preclude then under this application that person from immediately filing another claim.
What if your clients had, instead of going to probate court initially, went to family court and used 452.375 to establish a custody arrangement? And grandparents then went to the probate court to try to obtain a guardianship. Could they be successful? Would the probate court have authority to grant a guardianship after a custody arrangement had been set by 452?
Well, first, in that, just specific to that hypothetical, I don't think the grandparents could have sought an initial custody determination under 452.375, because that's a dissolution proceeding. And so in that case, there would have to be a motion by the guardian or by the grandparents, and they're entitled to that, to seek intervention in that case and get a custody order. But generally, had a custody determination been made under some scenario where that could be done, could they then go seek guardianship? No, I don't believe so.
Is that because the Uniform Child Jurisdiction Act would include an allegation in the guardianship petition that there was no other court that had pending jurisdiction?
I think that is definitely one reason. I think for that reason, the same application in the reverse order applies. Once there's already been a custody determination made, you shouldn't allow another court to then second-guess that or say, well, I would have decided it differently, so I'm going to make this decision that's in conflict with that order. I think that that's definitely not what was intended by this statute and was never considered. I think that there is a real danger here regarding this type of application, that it could have a real chilling effect on potential applicants for guardianship if there's a real need for that. Because in this scenario, a guardian, as in this case, strictly to take care of a child who's in need, gets legal custody of that child, and then has been forced to expend resources time and time again to defend various claims. And in this argument, under 375, saying that any party could come in and request third-party visitation or custody, and put a guardian in the situation of having to expend resources to defend those things that could have been spent on the child, I think could make potential applicants for guardians very wary about stepping in into the breach of a child in need and taking care of that child. And
I am having trouble finding this statute. What are the conditions, the procedural posture under which 402 applies?
402 applies, Your Honor, in a dissolution proceeding, or in a case
where a parent's died.
Where a parent has died and the other is denying visitation, or in a case where a child has resided with that applicant for 6 out of the last 24 months, and then they have been denied visitation for more than 90 days. And under any scenario, the appellants in this case could not meet the requirements of the grandparent visitation statute. And this certainly seems like an end around to what is authorized by statute to circumvent that statute and seek the same relief under a different provision.
Is there a reason that these 452 provisions and the 475, they're codified in different chapters? That the two statutes that are being cited, 452.402 and 452.375, apply to custody, apply to dissolution, paternity actions, and 475 actions are all codified under the guardianship chapter?
Well, I think there's certainly a reason for that as far as...
What applies to what?
Yeah, I think the guardianship and the conservatorship meets specific needs. I certainly think that that's correct. There are very similar provisions in 375 that could be met in a divorce situation or a custody proceeding if, again, the allegation is the parents are unfit, unwilling, or unable. But I think that is the only time that third parties can really step in and attempt to seek guardianship in an initial custody determination where that's in play. And I think it's, again, a very unique factual situation, and it was never intended to allow for what's being asked for here.
Any other questions? Thank you.
Thank you.
Judge Powell, you made me think with your question, which is, I guess, a testament to how good a question it is. But the I think you do point out a problem with the analysis from the guardians, that if this had been a situation where the parents had a custody determination independent of the guardianship, there was a paternity action under and. But they abandoned the child, and the child ended up with the maternal grandmother or my clients. Under the guardian's analysis, they couldn't go to guardianship. There'd already be a custody determination. That can't be right, and practically speaking, that isn't right. I've been involved in a number of cases where there's already been a custody determination in the family court in something under 452 or under paternity, and yet there was a subsequent guardianship proceeding. The two can operate independently. One, it is not a race to the courthouse. Whoever gets there first then has everything there. That's not the way practically it works. I don't think the trial courts put that in a position where one is to the exclusion of the other.
So are you arguing that the scenario where there could be a guardianship granted one day and the next day you can go and your client participated in the loss, your client can go the next day and file for some time under 452.375?
Well, first of all, I do think that's possible. That is common in the domestic area. I mean, it's not necessarily that it actually happens, but it certainly can happen where the minute there's a judgment and the minute that judgment becomes final, you can have a motion to modify right away. And unfortunately, there are some people that partake of that on a serial basis, but I don't think that's going to be the common situation. And in fact, in this case, the argument by guardians ignores the fact that my clients have already, first of all, in the initial guardianship proceeding, they didn't contest the guardianship. They didn't ask to be guardians, but they were along for the ride on the issue that the actual parents had were unfit and weren't available to parent this child. When they did seek to intervene and ask that the guardians be eliminated and that they be appointed as guardians, they not only lost in the trial court, but in an opinion by the Eastern District, were told, you don't have standing to even contest this because you are not an interested person. So they're in a catch-22 right now as I listen to the argument. On the one hand, they're told to go to guardianship. On the other hand, they're told, no, but you actually can't go to the guardianship. You can't accomplish, Judge Russell, what you suggested. That case is already out there, and it's been cited in the briefs. So I think that the specter that has been painted by the guardians of all these things that could happen, bus drivers and so on and so forth, coming along and asking for custody, is not exactly what we're dealing with. We're dealing with paternal grandparents that would like to have some sort of recognized rights to their grandchild. Thank you.
Thank you. Case will be submitted.